From Discourse to Action. Language, talk, conversation, discourses, and imagery are the medium of mass elimination. More properly, the media that prepare people to countenance or perpetrate mass murder and elimination. They become more eliminationist in potential when their eliminationist fundamentals constitute a substantial part of a society's or group's culture or subculture. And the manner in which a group's conversations deprecate other people critically informs its members' manner of treatment of them once an eliminationist campaign has been decided upon. We need to think more about several critical things we know too little about in general. Language as the soil containing the seeds of action, in this case mass murder and eliminationist politics more generally, the mechanisms transforming language and belief into action, and state-societal relations and the place of eliminationist language and discourse in them. One of eliminationist politics' most crucial and least understood aspect is how people, including potential perpetrators, make the transition from an initial language state and stage composed of prejudice and hatred or the desire to purge and transform society to a second one of talk of an actual elimination campaign, and then to the third in which the language of action is accompanied by its implementation. For eliminationist leaders, these transitions are generally straightforward and obvious. From prejudice and hatred, or the coolly calculated understanding of power, political leaders develop first the ideals of a partly or fully purged society, then the intention to turn the ideal into action should propitious circumstances materialize, and then, when the conditions for action are actually in place, they develop, promulgate, and begin to implement an actual policy of elimination. Ideals, in this case, are normative notions about a society's and polity's constitution and the hated or feared group's disposition. Intentions are the resolve to find a way to bring about that vision of a reconstituted society and polity. Policy is the actual implementation of plans reflecting the intentions. The distinctiveness, empirically and logically, of each of these stages is clear. It is analogous to the process of first wanting to build a house of your dreams, the ideal, deciding that the time has arrived, so you begin thinking about finding a property and engaging an architect, the intention, and then, after setting sights on the land and getting everything else in place, you acquire the property, commission a design, and build the house, the policy. Analyses of mass murder and eliminations typically fail to make these necessary distinctions, collapsing the three stages into an overwhelming focus on actual policy. To understand more than policy implementation's nuts and bolts, including identifying and making sense of imminently eliminationist political constellations, we need to explore in each eliminationist onslaught and future actual and potential ones all three aspects: ideals, intentions, and policy. Mehmet Talat, Hitler, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Saddam Hussein, Slobodan Milosevic, and Radovan Karadzic in Yugoslavia, and leader after leader went through these stages. Author's note: this is, however, not true of Lenin, and initially probably Stalin, the revolutionary vanguard of Marxist revolutions, supported at first by only 100,000 communists and unexpectedly governing a vast, mainly peasant and resistant society. They improvised a great deal, though in keeping with their Marxist understanding of how, under the urgent pressure of history, to forge the future utopia. For Hitler, the ideal of a world without Jews dated from his political career's beginning, which he articulated in one of his first political speeches in 1920 as the removal of the Jews from our Volk, which he specified during another speech that year as being so necessary that we are animated with an inexorable resolve to seize the evil, the Jews, by the roots and to exterminate it root and branch. Yet Hitler, then a beer hall rabble-rouser, was aware his ideals would remain idle until he had the capacity and opportunity to act. So he prophesied that an organization must arise, which one day will proceed with the deed. 2 years later, journalist Joseph Hell asked Hitler what he would do if ever he had a free hand with the Jews. Hitler, according to Hell, fell into a kind of reverie, was seized by a sort of paroxysm, raised his voice, and eventually shouted, "Once I really am in power, my first and foremost task will be the annihilation of the Jews. As soon as I have the power to do so, I will have gallows built in rows, at the Marienplatz in Munich, for example, as many as traffic allows. Then the Jews will be hanged indiscriminately, and they will remain hanging until they stink. They will hang there as long as the principles of hygiene permit. As soon as they have been untied, the next batch will be strung up, and so on down the line until the last Jew in Munich has been exterminated. Other cities will follow suit precisely in this fashion until all Germany has been completely cleansed of Jews." Hitler knew that for his ideals to be acted upon, he needed power. Once in power, more than a decade later, Hitler, the prudent politician, knew he must bide his time before erecting the gallows. Still, his eliminationist ideals did become firm intentions, which he began to act upon in the 1930s, first with generally non-lethal means. Then, with the attack on the Soviet Union in 1941, when a comprehensive lethal program against the Jews finally became practical, Hitler acted on his by then firm intention, initiating the genocidal assault. That Hitler's long-standing articulated murderous ideals preceded his formulated intentions or plans, which preceded implemented policy, is, as his own public and private words repeatedly conveyed, irrefutable. For Mao and the Chinese communist leaders, the ideal of a transformed and purified communist society derived from Marxism. The knowledge that they must use violence to achieve it derived from the experience of their mentors, the Soviets. Therefore, the intention to practice thoroughgoing eliminationist politics took shape much earlier than it had with the Soviets, crystallizing in mass murderous thinking as the communists' victory over the nationalists and assumption of power neared. In 1948, Mao, in Agrarian Reform study materials, conveyed to the party membership that his schemes for restructuring overpopulated China required that 1/10 of the peasants would have to be destroyed. 1/10 of 500 million is 50 million. In 1948, Zhen Pixi of the Communist Party's Central Committee declared in a speech to the party cadres that 30 million landlords and rich peasants would have to be destroyed. The communist leadership's intention, already well formulated and communicated to their ideologically like-minded followers, they began, upon taking power, to implement their eliminationist policies in programs of population movement, mass executions, and mass incarcerations of landlords, rich peasants, and other class enemies in the vast camp system they created. The communists exterminated Chinese on the order of magnitude that Mao and Zhen had foretold well before they had begun. The Serbian leadership had long harbored the ideal of eliminating non-Serbs and non-Orthodox from their dreamed-of Greater Serbia, which, as part of Yugoslavia, was peopled by other ethnic groups. Among the many striking aspects of the Serbs' mass murderous and eliminationist assault on Croats, Bosnian Muslims, and Kosovars are the many Serbian intellectuals involved, having also prepared the killing fields by enunciating and broadly disseminating eliminationist ideals among ordinary Serbs. The most widely read and influential Serbian literary work among Serbs was The Mountain Wreath, an epic poem published in 1847 by Vladika Pitar Petrovich Njegoš, who was the Montenegrin Orthodox Church's head, Montenegro's ruler, and modern Montenegrin and Serbian literature's founder. The Mountain Wreath explicitly glorifies and calls for mass extermination. This Archbishop's poem, recognizing different eliminationist means functional equivalents, and that the heretical enemies are, as heretics in principle are, redeemable, adopts a broader eliminationist tone, offering Muslims the eliminationist choice, convert or die. The blasphemers of Christ's name we will baptize with water or with blood. We'll drive the plague out of the pen. Let the song of horror ring forth, a true altar on a blood-stained rock. Grounded in this blood-stained, horror-exalting poem and vibrant corpus of literature, art, folk songs, symbols, and mythology, especially the Kosovo myth calling for vengeance against the Turks, a synonym for Muslims, and the Serbian Empire's re-establishment, Serbs developed a cultural orientation portraying themselves as a Christ-like victim people, needing to turn the sword on their enemies to recreate Christian Serbian virtue's lost kingdom. In an infamous Serbian memorandum published in 1986, 16 members of the Serbian Academy of Arts and Sciences called for Serbs to prevent the further strangulation, indeed a grinding cultural and actual genocide of their people, and thereby provided the intellectual ideals and foundation for Milosevic to act when the opportunity soon presented itself. 200 Serbian intellectuals submitted the memorandum as a petition to the Yugoslavian and Serbian National Assemblies. It declared, "In less than 50 years, during two successive generations, the Serbian people was twice exposed to physical annihilation, forced assimilation, conversion, cultural genocide, ideological indoctrination, devaluation and rejection of its own tradition under an imposed guilt complex, and intellectually and politically disarmed. All Serbs had to be brought together into one nation-state for self-defense and to vanquish their enemies in their midst." Such was the Serbian social discourse structured around an ideal enunciated in poetry, myth, and scientific pronouncements long before a firm intent could crystallize and long before political organization came into being and opportunity materialized to make these Serbian intellectuals, poets, and leaders' ideals the basis for a practical program and an executable policy. More than in any of our time's other eliminationist assaults, the Serbian leaders had imbibed and themselves helped to construct a discourse composed of a set of articulated eliminationist ideals glorified in hortatory literary works, including poetry. When opportunity appeared, a striking number of such literary mass murderers forged the sword from the pen. Radovan Karadzic, a practicing psychiatrist and published poet, powerfully embodies how ideals precede intention and then their realization in policy. In 1971, he published the poem Sarajevo, which, like many of his poems, courses with the images of annihilation it foretold. "I can hear the disaster actually marching, transformed into a bug. When the moment arrives, it will crush the bug as a worn-out singer is crushed by the silence and transformed into a voice. The city is burning like a lump of incense. Our conscience is twisting in the smoke, too. Empty clothes glide through the city. The stone built into houses is dying red. The plague." Karadzic would become the Bosnian Serbs' leader and the orchestrator of the Serbs' mass murder and elimination in Bosnia. This included their almost four-year siege of multi-ethnic and therefore detested Sarajevo, destroying much of the city, systematically shelling its cultural institutions housing Bosnian Muslim history and culture, killing thousands and driving away many more. Finally, Karadzic was able to fulfill his once idle ideal 20 years later, so he did. Vuk Drašković was even more explicit about his early mass murderous ideals. Perhaps the leading figure among the Serbian writers' cultural surge in the 1980s, he produced a spate of novels spreading anti-Croatian and anti-Muslim eliminationist ideals. Drašković, picking up on the deeply entrenched Serbian literary tradition of demonizing Muslims, penned a personal dedication to one of Vojislav Lubarda's own novels, The Prayer, which he sent to Lubarda thanking him for his inspirational novels conjuring hatred and calling for revenge against Bosnian Muslims, glorifying violence and revering the knife. Drašković, adopting this theme in his own novel, The Knife, wrote Lubarda, "While I was writing The Knife and both prayers, and even The Judge, I could not shake off myself, out of myself, the excitement, the desperation and the desire, a horrible and immense desire to transform my pen into a sword. An excitement that has haunted me since the day when I read your proud stumbling. I thank you for it." Drašković's ideal, his desire, lay dormant. Then, opportunity came. So this immensely popular and influential Serbian novelist, weaver of eliminationist ideals, founded and led a major Serbian nationalist political party and established the paramilitary Serbian Guard that committed mass murder and eliminations against Croats and Bosnians. The Serbian Guard's military commander explained that Drašković's words, his ideals, had moved him to action already in the 1980s, before Yugoslavia's breakup. "I beat up many Muslims and Croatians on vacation in Kavtat, Croatia, because of his nož, the knife. Reading that book, I would see red. I would get up, select the biggest fellow on the beach, and smash his teeth." For political leaders, followers, and like-minded populaces, the various stages of ideals, intentions, and action, and the transitions through them, are less clear and more variable. Generally, followers move through a phase of discourse, a societal conversation – the regime might take a prominent, even preeminent role – about the putatively problematic people that is typically heavy in deprecation, imprecation and hatred, and light and vague in proposals. Then, around the time of the leadership's decision to attack, to considering programmatic solutions to the problem, and then, finally, to a conversation about action and the willingness to act, and, for those participating, the action itself. We saw Adolf Eichmann describing the three stages he went through. "I was an idealist. When I reached the conclusion that it was necessary to do to the Jews what we did, I worked with the fanaticism a man can expect from himself. First his ideals, then his conclusion about the right policy, then his willingness and devoted action." The populace usually skips the intention stage – after all, ordinary people do not formulate policy – which is when the wish for a policy exists, yet leaders must wait for the right time to enact it. For the populace, the three stages of variable length are imbibing and spreading notions about the putatively problematic people's noxiousness, including often only some vague solutions, then either being signaled or learning of an impending solution, and finally resolving to support it or not, including those called upon to willingly take part in the eliminationist assault. In Kenya, the British settlers easily moved from having initial beliefs dehumanizing the Kikuyu to, when facing a powerful Kikuyu liberation movement and a few attacks, believing in radical action to meet the Kikuyu's threat, to finally accepting, or as many did, even agitating that the radical measures must be eliminationist, even lethal. When dehumanized people appear to be no longer manageable or useful to those dehumanizing them, it seems so sensible as to feel natural to move rapidly from a utilitarian stance of domination and exploitation to being willing, even eager, to kill them or exploit them more brutally. Such a stance predominated among the British colonialists from when they colonized Kenya in the first part of the 20th century. Francis Hall, who fought the Kikuyu, explains, "There is only one way of improving the Wakikuyu, and that is wipe them out. I should be only too delighted to do so, but we have to depend on them for food supplies." When the British came to see Kikuyu as undependable and, worse, an active threat, they altered their practical thinking. For some British, the transition was immediate. For others, holdout liberals, it lasted a year. The British moved from the half-century-long classical colonial domination, land expropriation, and labor exploitation stance to seeking near-total elimination, with differences only about the appropriate mix of killing, expulsion, and incarceration, and, for some, rehabilitation. Frank Lloyd, a Briton later knighted for his service to the British Empire, worked in the colonial administration throughout the eliminationist assault. Mau Mau, he explained, was bestial, an evil movement. He left no doubt about his and others' conclusions. Mau Mau had to be eliminated at all costs. And by any means, as something had to be done to remove these people from society. Again and again, one group's members make an easy transition from an initial state of holding dehumanizing and/or demonizing beliefs about other groups or people's perniciousness, which in their daily lives are tertiary, simmering with only latent potential beneath the surface, to a second state of these same beliefs becoming utterly central to their bearer's consciousness and stance toward society and politics. All people can think of notions, beliefs, emotions they have about one thing or another that exist in relative states of latency, often for long periods, and then when circumstances change suddenly, become far more central and urgent in their lives, thinking, and acting. This happens commonly with religious beliefs. During her life, a person's belief in God may move between a relatively latent state of keeping God at bay, to times, perhaps during a personal crisis, a family death, or developing a relationship with a more religious person, when God becomes more central, perhaps only to recede again and then continuing to ebb and flow, becoming more and less present, more and less of an accepted guide to practice, including church attendance and self-governance. The bedrock belief in God may never change. How important or central it is in the complex of that person's beliefs about the world and in his or her complicated personal and social life with all its personal, professional, and communal demands, how that person understands God's place in his or her inventory of conduct, and many other aspects of that person's life can vary enormously from being relatively latent to relatively manifest. Less exalted beliefs, including eliminationist ones, move along this latent manifest dimension. Bedrock beliefs demonizing or dehumanizing others that include hatred, prejudices, and fantastical notions suggest in their logic that those people should have their pernicious qualities neutralized. Yet such beliefs might also find, depending on personal, social, and most critically political conditions, circumstances, and opportunities, lesser and greater expression and be a lesser or greater guide to action. One Yugoslavian diplomat, a non-nationalist ethnic Croat, who knew from his own experience that only the communist dictatorship's force had made the intense hatreds latent, used to love traveling in Bosnia's lovely countryside and entrancing cities and towns. Yet he knew there was a darker shadow to it all, not yet premonitory for us, but causing unease. We also sensed something was amiss. What was it? To be sure, the visible evidence of an undisturbed, ethnically mixed life was real, but something seemed to smolder beneath a kind of second reality. Undercurrents of intolerance and suspicion could be spotted in unguarded, chance remarks of hateful envy, or in snide comments about those Croats or Serbs or Muslims always sticking together. In occasional displays of rage over real or alleged pork barrel monies, always benefiting them. And in furtive glances at Muslims going to the mosque in a largely Christian village, or at Catholics or Orthodox going to their churches in predominantly Muslim towns. Sotto voce, one was told of widespread mutual mistrust, more in the countryside than in Sarajevo, but in some Sarajevo suburbs too. But this particular darker shadow was nothing uniquely Bosnian. It is equally descriptive of the conditions in the 1970s and particularly in the 1980s in many regions and localities all over Yugoslavia. Superficially, Serbs and Croats got along with each other and with Muslims without their prejudices, suspicions, or hatreds being extinguished. Their simmering antipathies persisted despite the communist leadership's genuine endeavors to expel them from the minds and hearts of Yugoslavia's various ethnic groups, who, clinging also to their ethnic identities, never became Yugoslavs. The communist leadership's multi-ethnic composition, Josip Tito was a Croat, the other leaders were Serbs, Slovenes, and Muslims, and the Marxist teaching of socialist harmony enforced by state power, produced a thin veneer concealing the latent hatred. In Yugoslavia, as elsewhere, this time servicing an anti-eliminationist ideal, the government was ineffectual in teaching people views that went against their deepest beliefs and values. During the 1970s, the time of greatest Potemkin harmony, one elderly Serb confessed about Croats, in the words of the American diplomat to whom he spoke, that sometimes when he looked into their eyes, he could not help recalling the blood that stained the hands of those responsible for the slaughter of Serbs during the Second World War. He could not help recalling this, but he recalled it only sometimes under the Tito years' politically imposed and harshly enforced long truce and cohabitation. One can easily see such thinking quickly moving from this relatively latent state to being manifest, central to this man's views about and bearing toward the Croats in his sphere, when socialist harmony's patina dissipated in a historical instant and expressing ethnic identities, prejudices, hatreds was unshackled, allowing ethnicity to resume as the main organizing principle of the country's social and political life. So this man smiled disingenuously when such smiling was life's condition, conscious of his real animus toward Croats, perhaps a mixture of hatred and anger, and of questions about what the Croats would again do with opportunity. Would he have smiled the same once life's conditions, once his country's and region's politics no longer demanded it, but instead allowed for the opposite and more? The same Serb harboring the same beliefs about Croats could, as so many did, become utterly transformed in his outward stance as his beliefs migrated from relative latency to a manifest state calling for urgent action. Hence the reams of testimony, especially from Bosnian Muslims, about their once friendly neighbors falling upon them, revealing themselves to harbor the worst views and expressing them physically by beating, raping, torturing, driving from their homes, and killing those with whom they, as this Serb had, once lived and worked side by side, smiling. Tutsi survivors and Hutu mass murderers alike recount how the Hutus' hatred for Tutsi and discrimination against them was the underlying context for neighborly coexistence, which, contrary to how some portray it, particularly foreigners who did not live it, was often not so neighborly, and also the context for the Hutus rapidly turning on them. I spoke about the issue with Esperance Nira Rugira, a rape victim whose parents, six brothers, and other relatives, Hutu neighbors all, cut into pieces with a machete. Question: were these just local people who lived near here? Answer: yes, they were living here. They were not only neighbors, but also our friends. Why would they do that to your family and to others? I really don't know. That one who killed my father was a good friend of his, very close friend. My dad had given him a cow. I really don't understand.
Did anyone force them to do it?
No. They killed us saying that we were Tutsi.
Did you hear them say other things that would tell us anything about what they thought of Tutsi or why they were doing it?
They were saying that Tutsi are dangerous, that they are snakes, they should be all killed, they should be exterminated.
And did many people say this?
Yes, very many people were saying that.
How is it that they were one day living together and friends, and then how did it change?
I really don't know. They changed like animals.
We were living together, marrying each other, and people had kids together. Her friend, also a rape victim, Conchessa Kayaraba, agrees that the government sensitized the Hutu, but they wouldn't have done it if they hadn't wanted to. They would have said that this person has shared everything with us, water, they have given us food, and so on. People you have given cows are the one who came and killed you. People who had married in both families killed their grandchildren. There are so many Hutu women in this area who took their children to hide them at their parents, and they were killed by their brothers. During the genocide, people had changed. They had become like animals. They did not have any mercy for anyone. Nyirarugira is clear about the reason for this. Based on what I saw, Hutu thought of Tutsi as animals. They did not have the value of a human being. Where did it come from? Question. Before the genocide, did you hear any anti-Tutsi propaganda? Answer.
Yes, people were saying it.
But what kind of things were being said?
You could pass some people and they shout at you saying, "Look at that cockroach! Look at that snake!" All those kind of names. And during that time, no Tutsi kid would pass in school.
Kayaraba elaborates.
Hutu thought of Tutsi as animals because they were even calling them snakes. They were saying that when you want to kill snakes, you hit them on the head. They said a lot of things, but they thought of us like animals, dangerous ones. They called us snakes most of the times because a snake is a very dangerous animal and poisonous.
According to their friend Veronique Mukasinafi, who with the others are part of a community of rape and genocide survivors, the Hutus used the very same language, image, and motivations from 30 years earlier when Hutu, then persecuting and killing Tutsi, apprehended her father because they wanted to kill him. They took him and they were going to kill Tutsi, saying that they were cockroaches. They were calling their children snakes. Even in schools, they were calling upon Tutsi to stand so that they can see them and Hutu to stay seated. Children were growing up knowing that they were either Tutsi or Hutu. A powerful, long-standing social discourse in the family, in the schools, by the government, with many signal moments, including the 1959 Hutu assault on Tutsi, conveyed the essential prejudicial notions and fanned the hatred. The Hutu killer, Eli Ingarambi, conveys the essence of this deeply rooted discourse of multiple strands. I am 38 years old. I went to school even though I did not attend primary and go to secondary. But at school in 1983-1984, I was studying in 5th grade and 6th grade. We used to be taught history. As soon as we entered the classrooms, they were asking your identity. They were asking, who were Hutu? You, this one, is a Hutu, son of this one who was born there. Or, this one who is a Tutsi was born in that place or there. So we grew up hearing those things. But we were also hearing the same things from our great-grandfather. We were hearing it also from our grandfather. When the war began in 1959, people, Tutsi, managed to flee. They went to the church and they managed to survive. Others went to the neighboring provinces and they survived. But you think about it, people were united that time. As the time went by, the cruelty also increased. The authority became tougher. The authority took tougher measures. The enemy became Tutsi. In 1959, Tutsi felt discriminated and they fled away. After the Tutsi had fled, Habyarimana took over the power in 1973, and that is when things became worse. It was impossible for Tutsi to get places in schools, and they couldn't get jobs. That is when they started the ideology of discriminating by region and race. It started to be chaos, slowly, slowly, and it was time for multiple political parties. Things became worse. Even the kid that learned that in school put it in practice based on what the teacher taught him. And that is how the killing started. Hutu executioners describe how, while growing up around and playing soccer with Tutsi, they thought the worst things about them and said, as the mass murderer Pio Mutungurihi reports, that we did not want them anywhere around us anymore. Yet, without the circumstances to act on these beliefs, they nevertheless lived with them relatively untroubled side by side. Another Hutu killer, Leopold Twagira Yizu, captures this dissonant situation's social and psychological complexity. It is awkward to talk about hatred between Hutu and Tutsi because words changed meaning after the killings. Before, we, Hutu, could fool around among ourselves and say we were going to kill them all, and the next moment we would join them to share some work or a bottle. Jokes and threats were mixed together. We no longer paid heed to what we said. We could toss around awful words without awful thoughts. The Tutsi did not even get very upset. I mean, they didn't draw apart because of those unfortunate discussions. Since then, we have seen those words brought on grave consequences. As Pio observes, believing and saying the things the Hutu did about the Tutsi, including drawing the logical conclusions about how they should solve their Tutsi problem, it's already sharpening the machete. And when the Hutu leaders activated the latent beliefs, ordinary Hutu took out their already sharpened machetes and used them. Simmering, smoldering hatreds conveyed in everyday talk are powerful, with a violent potential ready to be tapped. Ingarambi says it well that in the immediate period before the genocide, as the anti-Tutsi public discourse intensified, the hatred grew, and things became worse when they said that the president's plane crashed. Because of what the Hutu were taught, they thought, the enemy has come. He is going to kill you. They are fighting to come and take over the power. So let's kill the Tutsi and finish them all, and we keep the country to ourselves. The Indonesians' mass slaughter of communists surprised nearly all Western observers. Yet when the military engineered one eliminationist context, falsely blaming a failed coup on the lawful and peaceful Indonesian Communist Party, the passionately anti-communist military and religious political parties, with American encouragement, easily decided to initiate the annihilation of the communists. Once deciding upon this eliminationist solution to the electorally ascendant Communist Party's political and social challenge, they easily mobilized anti-communist supporters across Indonesia, many being deeply religious, usually Islamic, of religious parties and orders' followers, who butchered the atheistic communists among them, usually with bayonets or machetes, often leaving their bodies in rivers or caves, a potent warning to other would-be communists. The same has happened in so many mass slaughters and eliminations, from Turkey to the Holocaust to Guatemala to Rwanda, in eruptions that sometimes seem to come from nowhere, especially to outsiders knowing little more than that the perpetrators and victims were living intermingled, relatively violence-free. Yet upon closer examination, these withering assaults have been shown to enjoy widespread social approval and participation because of hibernating, simmering, or only partly expressed beliefs by the peoples or groups whose members have risen to slaughter or eliminate the people they have always in their heart of hearts wanted to be rid of one way or another. Often, members of the perpetrator's group attack in unorganized or impromptu assaults, riots, or pogroms the members of the group the politically centrally initiated eliminationist program eventually victimizes. This in itself indicates eliminationist beliefs' prior presence and their easy inflammation into violence. During the 1930s, this occurred throughout Germany's towns and villages once the Nazis governed Germany, and in Austria after Germany annexed it. Germans and Austrians previously living peacefully with Jews suddenly turned on them, sometimes at the behest of the regime's officials or paramilitary stormtroopers, persecuting them socially and assaulting them physically. In Germany, even before Kristallnacht, the orchestrated nationwide proto-genocidal assault on the Jews in November 1938,
Germans had made most of its rural areas and small towns Judenrein, cleansed of Jews, the Jews fleeing to the big city's relative anonymity. When in March 1938 the Germans marched in, ordinary Austrians spontaneously and ferociously assaulted and degraded the Jews among them, surprising even the Germans. Scenes of fur-bedecked Viennese women gleefully watching Jews compelled to wash streets with toothbrushes were emblematic. Then, when the German government moved the eliminationist assault to its mass murdering phase, many of these and other ordinary Germans and Austrians willingly lent themselves to it, body and soul. A particularly significant moment when latent eliminationist beliefs became suddenly activated occurred across Eastern Europe, including in many locales in Lithuania, Ukraine, and Romania, in the immediate wake of the Germans' attack on the Soviet Union at the end of June 1941. With the Germans' emerging exterminationist assault upon the Jews giving the green light to the local peoples to vent their hatreds in violence, they sometimes in security forces, sometimes in paramilitaries, sometimes in impromptu groups, fell upon the Jews who for generations had lived among them, slaughtering them mercilessly, torturing them gleefully, sparing the Germans from doing the job themselves. In eastern Galicia, Ukrainians rose up to slaughter Jews in village after village. Yoshua Gertner, a survivor, reports from eastern Galicia's Kosov region. "We received reports from villages in the high mountains that initially struck us as hard to believe. The Hutsuls in the village of Yablonika, part of a mountain-dwelling Ukrainian group that had always lived in peace and harmony with the Jews, had seized the Jews in the village, locked them in a cellar on the pretext that the Romanians were coming to exterminate them, and herded them into the torrential Cheremosh River, where they all drowned. The man who had instigated this crime was reportedly the village priest. Only one Jewish woman survived. She fled to Kosov after the culprits had gone away. The next day, the Hutsuls entered the neighboring village. To assure that no one would escape, they bound the Jews in barbed wire in groups of three before they tossed them into the rushing waters. There were 74 victims. The murderers looted everything they had left behind. Having completed their slaughter in the neighboring village, they went on to nearby Hriniowa. The Hutsuls who lived there, however, would not let them enter the village, maintaining that the killing of Jews was a matter for those native to the village, not for outsiders. In Hriniowa, no Jews were murdered. The local Hutsuls merely drove them from the village to Zabi and then looted their possessions. In Kosov, Hutsuls recounted what their priest had said about this in his sermon. Those from Yablonika were much liked in the eyes of God because they had both dispossessed and drowned the Jews. They would certainly be rewarded with paradise. But the Hutsuls from Hriniowa, the priest intoned, would not enter the Garden of Eden. Yes, they had totally dispossessed the Jews, but, for having been so neglectful as to spare their lives, would surely go to hell. This uncoordinated but similar array of exterminationist forays led by local elites, including sometimes priests who consecrated the exterminationist assaults, expressed the dual pathology of the powerful anti-Semitism coursing through the local cultures and peoples. The first pathology was the anti-Semitism itself, which, though differing from the racist-based form predominating among Germans, nevertheless was a fearsome religious-based anti-Semitism, thoroughly demonizing the Jews as Christ-killers, spoilers, and exploiters. The second pathology was this first one's outgrowth, namely the anti-Semitically induced identification of the local Jews with the godless Bolsheviks, who had since 1939 occupied these regions, owing to the Hitler-Stalin pact that had temporarily carved up Poland and other parts of Eastern Europe between the two mass murderers. Because the local peoples, as a matter of anti-Semitic hallucination, conceived of the Jews collectively as Bolsheviks, working with the Bolsheviks, committing or supporting the Bolsheviks' crimes when the Soviets retreated before the Germans' military onslaught, they rose to rid themselves finally of the putative alien and pernicious Jewish presence, and did so with vengeance's ferocious motivational fury in the most telling and cruel ways by the hundreds and thousands in community after community. These mass murders are particularly significant because they, like so many of our time's eliminationist assaults, demonstrate latent eliminationist beliefs rapidly channeling toward mass murder. And for two other reasons. Across regions and countries from the north of Eastern Europe toward the south, the same latent hatred, without coordination, issued in kindred murderous results. Second, the local peoples committing the mass murder served not their own governments, but an alien occupying force that had no legitimate authority over them whatsoever. The local peoples turned perpetrators were in no sense acting under state compulsion, or being obedient to authority, or being subjected to peer pressure by those serving in state units, or carrying out bureaucratic assignments. The local peoples turned willful perpetrators, finally able to act with impunity, were plainly and simply having a go at and taking revenge on the hated and demonized Jews. If we think clearly about what we know about individual and social life in general, instead of allowing exterminationist and eliminationist assaults enormity to turn our heads inside out and to be explained away with mind-numbing clichés as out-of-this-world phenomena, then we can immediately grasp the normalcy of simmering, latent beliefs suddenly becoming manifest, potent, and deadly, and politically, which means as part of politics, how this works. How many individuals know others they believe, correctly or incorrectly, have wronged, injured, or treated them grossly unfairly, and, if allowed, would be happy, even eager to beat up, teach a lesson to, pay back, perhaps kill them, and to do so with gusto? Some people feel this way about neighbors, co-workers, members of their social circle, not to mention competitors, outright antagonists, and those having vanquished them. Yet, with exceptions, these same people do not express their anger and hatreds, their conception of their tormentors due, in action or usually even verbally in public. Perhaps they do not think about it much, certainly not in these terms, because vengeance's sine qua non, the opportunity to act with impunity, will never present itself. Yet if opportunity ever materialized so the angry, resentful, and hating person could act with guaranteed impunity, even with social approval, then he likely would take his vengeance. If we think beyond one individual to many people with such simmering hatreds born of the belief that another's willful hands had unjustly and gravely harmed each of them, would we not expect many to eagerly exact revenge when socially sanctioned opportunity and impunity appeared? Why is it so hard to accept the same about the subterranean phenomenon of dehumanized and demonized conceptions of other people and other groups, of beliefs as pernicious, dangerous, a source of great injury or a potential threat? They too burst out when political leaders offer such views bearers the opportunity to vent them in word and particularly in deed. This is the real beast within unleashed. It is not some Conradian brute indiscriminately assaulting any targets just for fun, or some willless automaton killing anyone just because someone tells him he should, or some fictitious bureaucratic mentality supposedly controlling the minds of modern man and woman. The beast is the latent prejudices, hatreds, and beliefs in others' guilt or danger, which, when widely socially shared, quickly become manifest and can be politically mobilized to produce eliminationist conflagrations. Nothing could be more ordinary.